This podcast may contain disturbing content for some listeners. It's intended for mature audiences. Listener discretion is advised.
Katie Beers, a poster child synonymous with kidnapping and captivity. 20 years ago, she was saved and only now is telling her story. By all appearances, she's living a normal life, close family, two beautiful children, but the road here has been a torture journey.
Was it difficult for you to talk about?
Talking about the specifics of the abuse is where it gets difficult.
Good evening. Katie Beers is missing, 9 years old.
Katie Beers became national news back in December 1992, just 2 days before her 10th birthday. Katie was living with her godmother, Linda Ingleri, at the time.
I won't be able to sleep. I can't get her off my mind.
On that day, a family friend named John Esposito, known in the Long Island neighborhood as Big John, picked her up from her house and took her to buy a birthday present.
So I figured, let's go to Toys R Us, I'll buy you a birthday present.
According to Big John, he bought Katie a video game, then took her to this arcade. When she went to buy tokens, he claimed she simply vanished.
She was walking towards the machine.
Worry turns to panic.
Get in touch with me any way you can.
Katie's godmother gets a message on her answering machine.
It turns out to be Katie, and she's sobbing. Click. That's all we had, and that results in Linda Ingleri calling 911.
Detective Lieutenant Dominic Verone and his kidnap investigation team have plenty of questions for John Esposito, the last man to see Katie.
He said something dirty happened to her.
That telltale remark instantly transforms Big John from a sobbing friend into the prime suspect. Turns out Big John has a big rap sheet. Years earlier, he pled guilty to grabbing a 7-year-old boy from a shopping mall. The cops raid his home, but instead of finding Katie, they discover a messy bachelor pad. Police set up a temporary command post on the property.
But he was very nervous about it and insisted that we remove our equipment and our detectors.
That seemed suspicious.
Oh, it did, but we had no choice but to oblige.
But all the while, Katie was close, very close. In fact, just a few feet below where the cops were standing. No wonder they couldn't locate her. Just like Jimmy Lee Dykes, Esposito had built an elaborate dungeon for his prey, ingeniously concealed. First, there was a bookshelf in Big John's office that had to be unscrewed and rolled out, revealing a closet. Under the carpet and under the linoleum, a 250-pound concrete trap door. And deep in that darkness below, the custom bunker Big John had built for Katie.
He told me to go ahead and go down, and I told him no, that I didn't want to, so then he threw me down.
And it was dark.
It was very dark.
Complete darkness?
Yes.
On her hands and knees, Katie crawled into this cold, musty compartment, virtually the only light from this television perched above her makeshift, soundproof coffin.
There were times that I thought that I could hear people upstairs. I would scream on the top of my lungs, "Help me, I'm down here."
And nobody heard.
No.
I'm not gonna hurt you, Susie.
It's a scene right out of the movie The Lovely Bones, where a child is snatched by a neighbor and hidden in an underground dungeon, just like Katie. But Katie says she was uniquely prepared for this ordeal. Why? Because unbeknownst to the police and social services, Katie had already been living a hellish life of abuse at the hands of her godmother's husband, Sal.
I was sexually abused, physically abused, emotionally abused, verbally abused.
As twisted as it sounds, Katie Katie believes it was her horrific home life which prepared her the hard way to survive John Esposito's dungeon.
I was so used to abuse that it didn't really have that much of an effect on me.
How did you survive the ordeal?
I did have to remove myself from the situation that I was in. I had to think happy thoughts.
You didn't sleep at all?
Not very much, no.
Why?
John wanted to take a picture of me laying on the floor looking like I was dead. And he wanted to then send it to the cops so that if they were looking for me...
You wonder if you saw this young girl around?
That they would stop. And when I refused to do it, he said, okay, we'll get it done another time.
For now, all the family can do is wait and worry.
In the tomb, Katie watched TV reports about herself and was determined to stay alive. Chained around the neck, she began manipulating her captor, forcing him to confront the future.
When I asked him how I would go to school, he told me that he would teach me what I needed to know. When I asked him how I would work, he would tell me that he had enough money for the two of us. When I asked him about getting married and having kids, he told me that when I was 18, he would marry me and have children with me.
So in some sick, demented way, he saw a future with you?
Yes.
Strategy works.
Katie, how are you feeling?
After 17 days of intense round-the-clock surveillance, Esposito cracks and turns himself in, leading Lieutenant Verone down to the Chamber of Horrors, just steps from where the police had been searching for her.
She was just yards away. Did you feel duped at all?
Yeah, we did somewhat, but when everyone saw how she was secreted and the efforts that he took, they understood it.
Verone was afraid of what he might find.
You'd expect to find a child after spending 17 days in an underground chamber, trembling, scared, cowering, withdrawn, and instead we find this upbeat young girl talking about things like her pet dog.
Esposito pled guilty to kidnapping, and Katie was placed in a new home with loving foster parents. Step by halting step, she started to piece together the childhood she never had. Against the odds, Katie attained something resembling normalcy. She went to high school, joined the cheerleading squad, and went on to college. Today, after 6 years of marriage and the dungeon 2 decades behind her, Katie has written her story in this book, Buried Memories.
My life is exactly what I had always wanted. Two parents who love me, and a husband and 2 kids, and a wonderful family. I'm tearing up.
For Katie, the kidnapping of little Ethan in Alabama brings back childhood memories she wants to forget.
Hopefully he's able to recover in such a way as I did by being able to remember what I needed to and then burying it when I didn't need those memories.
This week is sort of it ties back to last week with the missing kids stuff. We were looking at some cases that you and I have been following, but where this is really about people who are kidnapped but then found later to be alive. And I'm not doing the big cases like Elizabeth Smart. I am briefly going to touch on Elizabeth Schoaf, mainly because her kidnapper died recently, Vincent Filial. And that was a South Carolina case that I covered. I covered that one in real time as well, personally. But the case I wanted to start with, because we're going back to doing the summer about Israel Keyes, I have started to realize that Israel Keyes was not very original. And the first case that I wanted to talk about is a case that involves a pit latrine from a long time ago. And so it's weird for me to use people's names in these cases.
She's put herself out there quite a bit, though.
Yeah, so she's been out there in a way, like she is an active advocate for abused children.
Right. Now. And she says, like, she only knows how to survive. There's not another option. And so it's a good take on it from somebody who's experienced it for people who might be going through something like that.
So this is the case of Lori Poland. And Lori Poland is a Colorado case from 1983.
She
She was kidnapped at just 3 years old from the front yard of her Colorado home.
So I got in the car and off we went, and within moments we were gone.
Her abductor brutally abuses her and leaves her in an outhouse to die.
I know that I was loved and supported even though I was alone in a toilet.
36 years later, Lori Poland is a survivor and is now using her experience to change other people's lives.
Every day I wake up and I just try and be impactful and try and be good in the world and prevent people from growing up and causing harm.
Only on Denver 7 tonight, she is sharing her story with Denver 7's Jacqueline Allen.
She was playing with neighborhood children.
Before social media.
Oh, I just wanted that.
Before Amber Alerts, a three-year-old girl taken from her front yard in Sheridan by a man offering candy.
What happened on August 22nd, 1983 completely stopped the entire community of Colorado.
Lori Poland became a household name, her family's trauma on national TV.
Don't you think that you should have called the police to make sure that was true before you should have put that on the air?
Most people think they'll find a dead body.
But Lori was a fighter. 3 days after being kidnapped, bird watchers heard her cry from this forgotten outhouse near the I-70 Chief Hosa exit. The little girl found at the bottom of a 10-foot toilet pit.
Thank you, God!
This rare archive video capturing the terror and relief only her parents could feel.
Oh, Lori.
This is never
going to
happen again.
But to Lori Poland, this was just the start of her story.
Can I touch you? Can I hug you? Yeah, I get that all the time.
After all these years?
Yeah.
They still feel that connection.
Absolutely.
36 years later, her memories are flashes, images, feelings.
I know that I was loved and supported even though I was alone in a toilet.
She lived to keep fighting. This is the first ever publicly shown image of three-year-old Lori identifying the man who sexually abused her and put her in the hole.
She was rock solid in her identification. Her body language said, "Mommy, that's him," and she sort of reeled back. She was a little scared.
Dr. Richard Krugman was Lori's pediatrician at the time at the Kemp Center and shot video of this interview. In a controversial plea deal, her attacker was sentenced to just 10 years, serving only 6.
Do you feel like justice was served?
For me, it's not really about justice. It's more about being impactful. And every day I wake up and I just try and be impactful and try and be good in the world and prevent people from growing up and causing harm.
Now, a mother of 3 and a therapist herself.
I have a small therapy practice.
She's committed to making a difference for that 3-year-old girl, launching the National Foundation to End Child Abuse and Neglect.
Of course you do.
Teaming up with her childhood doctor, they want to treat child abuse not just as a social issue, but a mental and public health issue, like suicide and breast cancer.
We've been able to see a significant shift in all of those things because there's been a focus on prevention, education, research, and advocacy.
To this day, the ripple effects of what happened continue, but Lori Poland has never backed away from a fight. Not only for herself, but now for all children who have been abused.
I only know how to survive, and I will continue to survive.
She is an inspiration, and her foundation is taking pledges right now to end child abuse, trying to get 10,000 signatures. We put that link on thedenverchannel.com. And as for the man who dropped her in a toilet to die, he is alive and free in California. She's never talked to him, and she really doesn't want to anymore.
Oh, my. She really is an inspiration.
She is. That was powerful stuff. Thanks so for powerful. Sharing her story tonight. Gosh.
Thank you, Jacqueline.
What happened to Lori Poland is absolutely...
It's everybody's worst nightmare.
It really is everybody's worst nightmare. So,
and she was 3, so...
She was 3 years old when this happened. She was standing in her front yard. And a man, if you want to call him that, lured Lori Poland to his car with the promise of a popsicle.
That's all it took, a popsicle. So this little girl, like you said, was standing in her front yard. So you brought this case to me, and when I started looking into it, it's a little bit skewed because it's hard to find information about like the actual case because Lori Poland is speaking out about her experience. And so there's more of that available, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. It just doesn't give me a lot of insight into the actual crime and what happened. She was taken and I think you said she was lured by a popsicle. This child who was, this happened in 1983, and she was 3 years old. She was abducted and placed 15 feet beneath the ground inside of an outhouse toilet cesspit, where she was left for 3.5 days until some bird watchers who just happened to be out in the area where she was left heard her crying. And so they were able to find her. It was, a comment was made. So after she's taken, you know, they, I like I said, the accounts are now focused on her survivalism. But she, when she was questioned by the authorities, they, you know, they wanted to know, well, how long have you been there? And she was only 3 years old. So she said, I saw both day and night, you know, they were using things to relate to her. So she had, you know, they deduced how long she'd been there. And the first responders that recovered her when she was heard by the bird watchers, they sort of ominously told the media, like, whoever put her down there had no intention of her ever getting out of there. So whoever her abductor was not only abducted her and violated her, and, you know, I'm sure she was hurt, scared, but, you know, she was there to suffer. I guess she would have starved to death. I'm not exactly sure what would have happened there.
So I just want to say that this case, this is what I think happened to girls like the two Washington girls. Well, actually three in Washington. So Lindsey Baum, where Lindsey Baum's skull was found was near a pit latrine that was not as deep from what I read. And then I'm talking about, one of them is Cassie Emerson, and the other one is Julie Harris. I think that something similar happened to all of those girls. Not naming any perpetrator. I'm saying they were taken out into the woods, violated, and left for dead. This guy didn't have the wherewithal to kill this girl just to abuse her.
That's a very weird. Okay, so the elements here are she was kidnapped. Was she sexually molested and abused or not?
On her site, the way she tells her story is, in 1983, at the age of three, I was abducted from my front yard and taken to the foothills of Colorado. After being sexually abused, I was placed 15 feet beneath the ground in an outhouse toilet. When I was 10 years old, my kidnapper was released from prison after only 6 short years of being behind bars for rape, kidnapping, and an attempted murder.
Okay, so he was, I don't know why I had it in my head. I felt like there was an account that said, like, she wasn't actually abused, and I had trouble sort of figuring out exactly why he would have taken her, because that usually is, it's a pedophile, and then they're getting rid of their witness, but
she was definitely abused. It's in the court documents in detail.
I think maybe at first, so this would have been 1983. I think maybe they just weren't, they wanted to protect her privacy a little bit. I think that's.
Yeah, that's where this comes in that it's confusing, is they had highly publicized this abduction and then the recovery and then the court records. And he made a plea deal that didn't include all of those charges after multiple back and forth between the prosecution and the defense. And it wasn't he didn't go to jail for very long.
Which is it's just gross.
It really is gross. And that's the first part of this story that stood out to me, was all of these girls that are found, and I'm not saying they were all necessarily dumped into pit latrines. That's not the description I'm giving you. What I'm giving you is, this is a guy who wasn't capable of killing because whatever reason. And when it really got down to it, they molest the child and then they leave the child somewhere to die.
That's insane.
With like Lindsey Baum and Julie Harris and Cassie Emerson, I think those girls were in worse shape because the person with them was strangling them. And this is a very small child. So after he did what he did to her, you know, he drops her into a park toilet. Now, so it just so happens that Cynthia and Stephen Gollin that day, they were in Colorado, but they were lost. They thought that they had a plan to go out and they were going to watch birds. Finally, after hours of being lost, Steve pulls the car over because he sees an outhouse. His wife says she has got to use the bathroom. So she gets out. It's this abandoned dirt road. If you look at it on a map, I mean, it's a park. Don't get me wrong. Like it's a place that people go to look for nature. In this instance, they said they were bird watching. Cynthia goes into the bathroom and hears a little girl's voice yelling, as much as yelling can be done after 3 days.
I'm pretty sure she said, the voice said, Mommy, I want some Kool-Aid.
Something, I thought she said, Mommy, I want a popsicle. But I've heard, Mommy, I want a popsicle, and I've heard, Mommy, can I have some Kool-Aid? There was a reward posted by the Poland family. Diane and Richard Poland were Lori's parents. Their employer had put up a $5,000 reward, and that reward went to the Gollins, who are from Pennsylvania. They were literally just, these people were just on vacation in Colorado. They end up meeting Lori. There's several very touching, newsreel clips of these two families meeting. What's so interesting about this to me is it's technically not a murder, okay? But it was meant to be a murder. This little girl lived. She survived. And to this day, she talks about this.
I was going
to
say, it almost seems worse than murder. If it could
it's
be
It's like
something.
That moment in Silence of the Lambs where the girl is in the bottom of the pit. And that is what links this to our larger story overall. Because there are some small children who went missing. And there were some small children that show up in comparison searches on Key's computer. But my point is, putting a child into a pit latrine, because I've been called out in a couple of places on social media that that's crazy and it would never happen. Well, it already did happen. It happened in 1983. This little girl went to Disneyland. And from 1983 to 1989, she pops up in the news multiple times. And she pops up again in 1992. The reason that that happens is because the person who took her was going through the court system.
Yeah, and I feel like that is a slap in the face.
It really is. It is. It's a huge slap in the face. And one of the hardest things about this case is the victim was very, very vocal to be 3 years old and very engaged.
Right, and so she eventually identified her captor.
She identified the car, and other people had identified the car, and then there was an arrest of a gentleman named Robert Paul Thiret, or Thiret, T-H-I-R-E-T. That's the person who was eventually arrested, but she picked him out. So the person who picks him out at first was a 9-year-old girl who had picked out the abductor, is what I'll call him, since I can't pronounce his last name. She said that she knew who he was from the beginning, and that once she saw him in the paper, she knew that that was him. Descriptions had him having a mustache. You know how they talk about, like, people will change their appearance. By the time he showed up for anything, he was clean shaven. So I don't know if he was just unshaven, or if he never had a mustache, or if he did, and he changed his appearance. But this case alone is all of the intentions were to murder this girl.
No question.
Because she was put in a hole, and that particular hole was isolated, the only thing that was meant to happen to her was she was meant to die. And that's what young, immature killers, like this abductor turns out to be 21 years old. But
is
that's
that
what
how old
young
he was? 21?
Yeah, he was 21. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, when these young killers get into situations with small children, there's a moment where it's all what they were planning to do. Because this takes some planning. You got to know where you're taking them. You got to know what you're doing to them. Even if you're like making some of that up on the fly, you had to go out to snatch a young child. And he didn't have any particular child in mind that we know of, or he could have been stalking Lori Poland. That does not come into the picture here. But what is interesting is that applies, like, for the most part, planning or not, some of this is random.
Right.
Because you're, because if there was another little kid that was in a more appropriate circumstance for you, that's who would have been grabbed in place of Lori Poland. And she was, Lori Poland was in the hospital after this for the injuries that occurred to her. Primarily being in the cesspit for multiple days.
Yeah, that caused her to have, and this is really gross the way they put it, but so the circulation in her feet was affected by whatever liquid was in there. Like, so whatever she had been standing in.
Yeah.
So that, you know, obviously there would have been a risk of infection and she would have been in, so think about being in a pool. Right. You get wrinkly and everything. And so you're in this gross liquid and she could have very well had some of that stuff. You know, it could have possibly gotten into her system through her skin for that long. But yeah, so they were concerned about. And I think even when she went into the hospital, I think she was in fair condition. I don't know that she was ever considered to be in critical condition.
She got upgraded to serious, but she was not in critical condition.
Right, because so ultimately the injuries she sustained in and of themselves, they were horrific, but I don't think they would have killed her, and they didn't kill her because she was found. The whole point was for her to suffer until she died.
Right, this was just a convenient place for him to put her away where no one would find her. And if it hadn't been for the Gollins coming along and getting lost and having, you know, Miss Gollin having to go to the restroom, they never would have found her. This case, for the most part, it wraps up with as happy an ending as you can expect. She's recovered, and to this day, she has a book out now. I'll put a link in the show notes to her website where you can read more about her. She has an absolutely fascinating story.
She really does. It's definitely something. It's remarkable, and you know, I know this might not be the best way to look at it, but sometimes if you're having a bad day, you know, just read someone else's experience in life and feel grateful for what you have. This is one of those situations where this would make anybody feel grateful.
With that being said, I honestly think that if you hunted around, you would find this is a weird thing to say. I think that some vanishing kids cases in areas like this would turn out to be
in a toilet.
Either in a toilet or a cesspool or an outhouse tank, or I honestly think this, like, because if you think about, if you don't have kids, look at it from the strictly from a measurement perspective. Okay, start with a 6 foot tall man, you know, then go to a 5 foot tall, we'll say that could be a teenager. Then under that, you're at 4 foot tall, and if you're down in this range of like 3 to 6 years old, you're below 4 feet tall. That is a very small body you're disposing of. These outhouse toilets have a bucket on them that with two screws, and in some cases a latch, pops up and you slide it in and they're gone. Now, it's more complicated to get rid of an adult body in there, but small bodies going in there. Yeah, and she was alive. This is a living person. Because then, technically, once they've had the moment of embarrassment at realizing what they've done when they've molested this child, they don't have to deal with further embarrassment of killing the child. They're in such shock as well, because this is a young guy. This is a 21-year-old killer. And I am calling him a killer because that's what he intended to do. He may not have killed this girl.
What happened to him? Is he still...
He vanishes off the radar.
So is he still alive? We don't know.
I have not found an obituary.
It would be, I think it would be in his best interest to stay off the radar. I don't know that, so I feel like I can be very diplomatic and look at lots of sides of the story. And I don't know that, I think that coming face to face with somebody that I knew had put a 3-year-old in a pit latrine, a toilet cesspit. I think that might actually push me over the edge a little. So I think it would a lot of people.
This is a fairly unique case in the U.S. because the truth is, when it comes to these areas out here, Lindsay Baum was found near one. And Lindsay Baum has not been found entirely. Only parts of her were found.
So I have sort of two sides of this, because one of them is I don't want to give anybody any ideas. The other side of it is, like, we know this is a thing.
There's a location we're going to talk about later in the summer where I've been looking around and finding abandoned pit latrines and fires in abandoned pit latrines. And when things like that happen, I realized this. I agree with you. I don't want to give anybody any ideas. That's not where I'm coming from. The side that I'm coming from is law enforcement, in some regard, needs to address this. It sounds crazy to say it that way. A lot of outhouses and latrines out there still exist. This one in Colorado where this little girl was, they've moved that now. But it's still an outhouse in the same park, in relatively the same place. It's just not the same hole anymore. So what would have happened there is, if she would have died, that hole would have been filled in. They would have moved the structure over to a new slab over a new hole. And that's where she would still be today if they had not found her.
Right. And essentially nobody would know where she is.
Exactly. So with these pit latrine situations, it sounds bonkers to say, but you don't look in them. Like very recently, I was speaking with someone related to the Kayla Berg case, which is a comparison search on Israel Keyes' computer that has nothing to do with Israel Keyes. So as far as I'm concerned, when I was looking at her case, I realized they keep searching this one area in park near where she went missing. And it's because they have some kind of unreleased information that is making them search there. And Kayla Berg went missing a very long time ago. But for her to, they have a continuing search. I think the most recent search I read in the park was 2020 or 2019, with plans for more searches that weren't necessarily publicized.
What state was she in?
She's in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin.
Antioch, Wisconsin, right?
Yeah. I believe so. Because
Antigo. I'm sorry. Antigo.
Okay. So her case is weird for me because was refreshing my memory. But yeah.
Well, with her case, I really think that they keep looking in some area. Here's my theory. Either this guy that I have on my suspect list has told them a thing or said something or had a cell phone pinged near that area, or they found an item in that area that they believe is related to Kayla.
Right.
And I finally reached out to him and I was like, guys, you keep covering the same set of square miles there. I just want to make sure that you know that on this Google map and on this Google map, there are two locations of interest that you might not think about. And those are old outhouses. Because I have spoken to search and rescue people. Here's the deal. If you're camping and you go missing, they look in the outhouse. If you're hiking and you go missing, they might look in the outhouse. If you're from a city or, like in her instance, she disappeared, they think, near an abandoned home where someone was supposed to be living. I say abandoned, but vacant might be a better word. An empty home.
I was
going
to say, yeah, I think it was like foreclosed on, condemned, right. Maybe? So, I don't know.
So the house is empty. There's no people in it, and she goes missing. They're not going to go look in the same areas that I'm thinking when I say look in the pit latrine.
Because she wasn't camping. Because they're not following that line of thinking. And quite frankly, I don't blame them. And it sort of defies
logic, because you don't want to believe that people would do that.
Right, except, and so, yes, you're right. It defies logic in that you don't want to believe it, but it's actually the most logical place to put a dead body if you're trying to get rid of it. I don't know that I
should say that. And it attracts the least amount of attention. That's the other like risk we run talking about this, is I don't want to give people more ideas.
Because you've got, like, basically, we have had so many discussions about this, but you've got the smell of the decomposition basically covered. Okay. I mean, even if it's okay, so.
And in some cases, the chemical that they pour occasionally in there would also assist with the decomposition.
Right. And so when have you ever been like, oh, this outhouse smells really bad, let's go investigate? Like, nobody says that. It's going to smell bad. It's not surprising. And if it smells like decomp, it's an animal or something. That's what. So I'm saying, like, it really is. it's sort of the perfect disposal, and it's so terrible. And
it is.
So my nightmare is that, like, somebody listening to our show, like, comes and does that to us and puts us in a pit latrine. It's really terrible. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I'm going to be cutting that out.
Let's not give them any ideas.
But in all seriousness, like, other countries address this to some degree.
It seems
and other places address this.
It's either it's underreported or it's there's something off about the fact that this is so logical and you never hear anything about it. So you did investigate, like, okay, is this typically an area that's searched?
I talked to search and rescuers in Southern California, Colorado, Texas, and then I have someone close to me that does some search and rescue, and I asked him what he had learned in classes and what his overall take on it was.
And
he said if they're camping or picnicking or hiking, it's a possibility they'll look. He said the problem is not that they're not looking, it's that they don't know if someone is taken from their home. And for instance, I'm going to say if it's a woman, she's taken from her home in her bed at night and no one really knows where she went. Maybe she stepped out for a cigarette. Maybe she went to the store. Maybe she drove away and never came back. And they don't find their vehicle, like, in a place that makes sense, like it's in a store parking lot. There is no way to draw the line from that woman's last known place to be, say, her internet activity or her cell phone or whatever, to the pit latrine. Because phone's not coming with her, internet's not coming with her. So it's not that they don't want to look there. It's that they don't know to look there. Law enforcement doesn't know to look there. Yeah, it doesn't cross most people's mind. And that's what made it such an interesting idea. And in fact, I've reported about 8 cases where I think that people will probably be found in a pit latrine. Now, one of them, the search and rescue swore to me that they looked in the pit latrine.
Mm-hmm. And well, then they may not be there. I mean, it's just, it's something, it definitely doesn't hurt to, you know, put a bug in somebody's ear.
When I looked at the FOIA that someone else had done for this information, because this is an ongoing case where it's very similar to Bill Owosco. Like, there's someone that's personally gotten involved and they're, like, digging into it. There's not a clear tracking line is what I call it, where these people went out with GPS trackers. There is not a clear line by the pit latrine. So I'm not saying they didn't search
the pit latrine. Oh, I see what you're saying. You think that maybe somebody has assumed it's been looked at.
Right. It was in somebody's grid, and they checked off on that grid, or those people checked off on that grid, and they opened the door and looked, and there was nobody sitting on the concrete slab.
Yeah, so that's about how far I would take
it. In their mind, it's checked off, but it's not checked off from the perspective of, did they look in the hole? It sounds so crazy to say these things.
It really does, but it makes a lot of sense.
However, I have examples. And I have, so when I talk about Lori Poland happened in 1983. She was all over the headlines. And just like you said, when you say things out loud or things appear in the headlines, you get ideas from whatever reason. So somebody out there getting this idea and carrying it forward is not completely unheard of. A more recent case, because 1983, let's just face it, that's a long time ago.
It really is.
And I think people listening to me talk think, oh, that has nothing to do with things happening today. Well, in May of 2013, the last week of May, in Jamaica, and that's as close as I can get to giving you a good example that doesn't feel completely like third world, because most of the places that I find good searches and places where bodies have been found in pit latrines are in Africa and far, far, far South America.
What do you think makes the difference there?
I think it's the way that people police, and I think the
existence law enforcement's too good to look in pit latrines.
Well, it's not that. I'm not saying that per se, but like, you don't necessarily like do you know that pit latrines like really exist? Did you know that like there were pit latrines close to my house? Do you know that there's a pit latrine close to your house? You know what I'm saying?
Well, yeah, but only because I've done research for this.
Right. I don't think law enforcement thinks of that. And I don't necessarily think in general that people know that that has happened. So this is last week of May, 2013, in an area called St. Catherine. Three bodies are found in a very short amount of time. And there's a double murder that's considered to be retribution for one of these murders of children.
Right, it's crazy.
So an 8-year-old is found in a pit latrine in an advanced state of decomposition. This is a second grader. A second grader. A man was walking through an area where there were pit latrines. And here they're in parks, and some people have them on like larger hunting and farming lands. But they're primarily, for the U.S., they're in parks. In other places, they serve as additional public bathrooms in areas that don't yet have utilities. We have them all over the place. We just don't necessarily use them. Because if you're in a park hiking 5 miles and you know that like when you're done with your hike, there is a nice bathroom at the top of the park, why use the pit latrine? The initial discovery of this body in the pit latrine was made by a man who was using the pit latrine as he was passing by. He looked down into the pit and he saw 2 feet and he fainted. This little girl had been missing for multiple days at this point. A day before this had happened, they had found a 4-year-old girl in an old pit latrine nearby that was considered to be a sinkhole because it no longer had an outhouse on top of it. And hours after, in this area called Trelawney, they found the body of a newborn girl. So they end up having this double homicide of 2 men in this area. If you want to look these cases up, the girls' names are Tamara Lang, Natasha Brown. And the area that you would look it up is Duaneville, Trelawney, which is down near St. Catherine in Jamaica. And there's like a lot of weird things that happen around these cases and who the suspects are and whatnot. The important thing is 2 of these bodies, one is found actually in a pit latrine that's an active pit latrine. The other one is found in a former pit latrine where the outhouse has been pulled away from it. But the hole is not filled in. In the sinkhole, they couldn't pull Natasha Brown out because the way they had filled it in, it was too narrow to get back into it. But she was murdered. And with Tamara Lang, her body was in an advanced state of decomposition.
This is actually a little bit confusing because there is so much going on here. Did they come to the conclusion that the little girls were killed by the same people?
Okay, so this is like a pitchfork situation. Right. The locals decided that Tamara Lang had been killed by Clayton Parkinson and Tashawn Campbell. Now, that's not said the court decided
right. In
this area. That is to say that it looked like the police decided they felt like it was a reprisal attack for the death of Tamara Lang. But what they found was, this is May 30th, 2013, after this other stuff was happening. The police get a call at 2 a.m. and they go out to this area called Marchpen Road. And they found Clayton Parkinson, who was 33 years old. They found him in the yard. Now, he's not in a latrine. He's just laying there. His hands and feet are bound, and his throat has been slashed, and he's been left to bleed out. At the same time, they're alerted that a little further down this road, at Marchpen Road, there's a second body. And that's when they find Tashawn Campbell. All the autopsies are happening on, like, 6 cases at one time.
Right.
And like, legally, they stop reporting on it after that. Like, it doesn't come back up. Because in the eyes of the law, there's nothing they can do if the murderers have been killed by the locals. And also, this is Jamaica. This area is, in 2013, it's a little different. My point is, it's pit latrine is the chosen body disposal location. And it's 2013. And I feel like people can relate to Jamaica because Jamaica is not India. India is complicated to explain to people if they haven't been there and walked down the streets. They don't understand what I'm describing. Jamaica, a lot of people go to Jamaica. They vacation in Jamaica. They understand Jamaica. They can Google it and get an idea of what's going on there. That's why I used like the Colorado case of Lori Poland, and then these Jamaica cases, which the crazy part about that is you've got 30 years between the cases, but essentially the one little girl, the four-year-old girl, the same thing had happened to her. Now, Tamara Lang, there was a lot going on there where she was probably kept somewhere for several days and then put into the latrine. But the little four-year-old girl was essentially raped and dropped into the latrine.
Well, and so there wasn't a whole lot of information about the four-year-old. So the suspects were said to be Tamara's uncle and nephew, right?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that's a...
And they took a woman into custody for Natasha Brown. And that case drops off the radar, but you can go like digging and you can see where they do try to...
It's like everybody just went crazy for a minute there. I mean, that is insane.
Well, they even remarked that someone was carrying a pig. They thought it was a full moon and maybe there was a sacrifice. It's the craziest story to read because the way it was reported, like people didn't know how to report it.
And it was confusing. It jumps around quite a bit, and there's so many elements happening. But, you know, that poor little girl, it's really terrible.
It's absolutely an awful situation. We started with a survivor, and then we have this example of pit latrines in Jamaica. And the reason is because I don't want to talk a lot about pit latrines this summer. I want to talk about cases, one, that haven't really been connected to Israel Keyes, if they are Israel Keyes, but two, that the FBI kind of hides. And I really want to like get your opinion on a lot of the Keyes stuff. So that's sort of where we're going here. I do want to like leave this on a couple of cases that have had interesting endings. I talked a little bit about Elizabeth Schoaf. And Elizabeth Schoaf, her kidnapper, he died in prison in 2021. So that's recently.
Yeah, he was asking me just like the oddest questions, if I had a phone and if I was a virgin. And
if you're a virgin?
Yeah, of all things for a police to ask me. That's when I kind of was wondering what was going on. And then he just said that I was a smart girl and I should have figured it out. And then that kind of got me scared. That's when my heart started pounding because I knew something was wrong.
Of course, it was about to get much worse. Vincent led a shackled Elizabeth through woods and trails for an hour, doubling back, circling around, throwing off her sense of direction. And then he stopped her and bent down and picked up a piece of ground. And then she realized it was a trap door. There was a bunker down there.
What did he say to you then?
He had told me to go down the ladder and get into the bunker. He had like a rifle and a belt that had guns and handcuffs, and I saw a taser in it. So I knew he was well equipped to do anything if I acted stupid or whatever.
Inside, he closed the door, turned on a battery-powered light, and now Elizabeth understood why he asked if she was a virgin.
He pretty much just raped me.
Right away?
Pretty much.
Forced you to take off your clothes?
Mm-hmm.
How often did he rape you?
More than 2 times every day. Between 2 and 5 times a day. All I remember is that it hurt, of course, and I had looked off to the side to one of the shelves that were there. There was like a propane tank and dishes and stuff on it.
And you just stared at that?
Mm-hmm. Stared at it and cried.
Think you'll ever forget that shelf?
Mm-hmm.
Kept in that bunker, underground, naked.
Chained?
Mm-hmm. Chained where? How?
There was a chain that was hooked to like the roof part of the bunker, and he just had it down and wrapped it around my neck and locked it.
What did you assume at that point?
That I was kidnapped and that I was probably going to die.
But killing her quickly didn't seem to be her kidnapper's plan. He'd outfitted the bunker to keep them going for weeks.
It was like dirt walls, and then over the walls he had some kind of sheet of some kind of fabric, and then he just had like his own little homemade bed and homemade shelves and a retarded toilet.
A retarded toilet?
Yes.
What do you mean a retarded toilet?
It was a broken plastic chair over a bucket.
Elizabeth could see a stove, food, and heard Vincent talk about his water supply, a stagnant pond near the bunker. There was even a battery-operated TV.
Hi,
Vincent watched the news coverage of the abduction. He told Elizabeth, "You'll never be found."
I watched my mom or my sister or my aunt or one of the older people I saw in the news and just watched like them talk about how I was missing and they wouldn't put an Amber Alert out for me.
How did that feel?
It made me angry because they thought I was a runaway.
You saw the picture of yourself on television?
Yes.
Did it look like you at that point?
I hated that picture. I hated it with the passion. It was like one of my worst pictures, and they put it on TV.
What did you say about it when you saw it?
I was angry. Like, I was just like, why did they put that on TV?
The next day, it seemed to Elizabeth the deputies had figured out she'd been abducted and she was about to be rescued. She could hear helicopters flying above the trees and footsteps trampling overhead.
I could actually see their shadows walking across the door above me. And I'm just sitting there while they're right above me. And
you could see their shadows on the door of the bunker?
I didn't say anything, but he just came up to me and told me that I needed to be quiet. And if I said anything, all he had to do was taser me and it knocked me out.
And soon the helicopter thumped far away. And footfalls vanished from the ground overhead. Those searchers had seen nothing. In fact, the footsteps belonged to volunteers, not trained deputies who might have noticed something amiss. Vincent told her if someone got close enough to find the bunker, his booby traps would get them.
Tell me about those booby traps.
They were all pretty much on the way towards the water hole. And he showed me that one thing he had in the ground. It was between these two trees. And it was shotgun bullets that were like pointed upwards, and if you step on it, it'll shoot you in your feet.
He kept her there in his bunker, and day three became day four, and then five. The perpetual darkness left Elizabeth disoriented until she lost track of the time of day or night.
It smelled muggy, really, really muggy. And then at nighttime, it'd be really cold. I would sit there for like hours just thinking.
Thinking what?
About my boyfriend or my family or friends and just cry. Because that was all I could do.
In the deafening silence of the dank, smelly bunker, Elizabeth realized Vincent was right. The bunker was so well hidden, the search obviously a failure. She would not be found. She would die there. Unless. Gradually, the idea took form and became solid. If she was going to get out of this, she'd have to save herself. No matter what people would say about him later, there was no dispute about one thing. Vincent Filliaw had a finely honed talent for disappearing. Here, deep in the woods, is the entrance to his underground bunker. Look at it carefully. Do you see a door? That's where she was, in there. In his 48 square foot, 6 foot deep hideout, Vincent tormented 14-year-old Elizabeth.
I guess I pretty much just shut my brain down. It was painful, but I would just think about other things.
Like what things?
My family, my friends, and how to get out.
But if she did escape, Vincent warned her, her life would not be worth living anyway.
He told me that I needed to calm down, and that if I ever tried to escape and I got away, that he didn't have to get me to hurt me, and he knew how much I loved my brother.
That's the way he put it?
Mm-hmm. That's exactly how he said it.
He fed them with instant noodles cooked on his propane stove. They watched TV news coverage on his battery-powered TV. They took turns sleeping, she at night and Vincent during the day, while she sat chained to the rafters, watching him.
And then I had the thought of trying to kill him.
Well, he slept?
Mm-hmm. I tried.
Tell me about that.
He had a pellet pistol, and while he was sleeping, I grabbed it and I pulled the trigger to his head, but it got jammed. And I didn't want to unjam it because then he'd hear it. So I just put it away and cried.
And then in her desperation, she began to play with an insane idea. a sort of reverse psychology. What if she pretended she was falling for him?
How did you go about doing that?
I always would do what he told me to do, and like he'd always call me baby, so I'd call him that back, and he'd tell me he loved me, and I'd tell him I love him, and just I'd act like I really liked him and I wanted to be with him.
That takes some doing.
Yeah, I didn't like it, but I did it anyways.
And before long, he began to act like he was sweet on her a little.
Was he nicer then?
You were taken by a man who was posing as a police officer. He locked you into a pit that he had built in the ground on his property. And for 10 days, you were held. We have pictures of the pit where you were held. It was very small, hardly any light, in the middle of the woods. How did you get through those days?
How I survived, mainly prayer, hope, and just seeing my family on the news begging for me, knowing and hoping that I'll see them again. Just keeping faith kept me strong.
But I mean, he had explosives that I read he put on you when he would leave to make sure you didn't escape. He was sexually assaulting you throughout the days. How did you ultimately figure out a way to survive? How did you ultimately figure out a way to get through it? Because you were really clever. All the police have said just how extraordinarily smart you were in how you essentially manipulated him.
In the beginning, of course, I could only take everything how it was, whether he sexually was assaulting me or whether he placed a bomb around my neck. The only way to keep it as non-severe as possible was to agree and do what he said. If he told me to sit still and don't speak a word, then that's what I would do. I learned the nicer I was to him, the nicer he was to me, so to say that I enjoyed the sexual abuse made it much easier on me than as forceful as it could have been.
And he started to believe you. He started to believe that maybe he could actually have a life with you, correct?
He did begin to believe me. I would tell him that I liked it, and I would say, I love you. He would say he loved me back. He would make plans for us to eventually move away to some other state together.
And finally, you were able to get his phone. How did you do that?
In the beginning, I noticed that he would use his cell phone to talk to his girlfriend. And, of course, I wouldn't dare touch it or go near it. But, of course, I couldn't either way because I was chained to the bed. But as I gained his trust, he would not chain me anymore. And I would then send text messages to my mother as to where I was, who I was with, to immediately get help.
You knew pretty much you were on your own and that you had to come out with your own solution to get yourself out of there. And so sending those text messages, police were able to kind of triangulate the area that you were being held in. But it was really, I guess what, the news finally broke and you were actually watching TV with him. What happened then?
It was a Friday night, and the searching for me had died down very much. But that Friday morning, afternoon, we noticed helicopters were out, and people were walking around more. So we cut the television on to see what's going on. Of course, he being very scared and me being very hopeful that somebody found something. But I ended up convincing him to leave, that if he stayed, the police would catch him, but if he left, then I could run away with him later on once the searching died down for him.
So you're 21 years old, you graduated college, you have a profession. I'm so glad things are good for you, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk to us, Elizabeth.
I also want to mention Katie Beers. Have you ever heard of the case of Katie Beers?
Yeah, I have.
So in my mind, I think this is sort of a different version than So the pit latrine people, right, they drop these children in there because they're scared to kill them. But I think this is a different thing where someone wants to keep a person. And I've always wondered about that. Like, what would that look like? Would it look like it looks in the movies and the scary movies that we see? And we have a pretty good example of that with Katie Beers, who disappeared on December 28th of 1992. This was right before her 10th birthday. So she was a 9-year-old girl that on December 30th was going to turn 10. So she was lured to the home of family friend John Esposito by the promise of birthday presents. And she had left a message on her godmother's answering machine. So this is a friend of her mom, Marilyn Beers. Now, this was traced by police to a payphone near the Spaceplex indoor amusement park in New York. So police determined that the message was from it was double recorded. So the call is Esposito calling her godmother.
And it was on the answering machine.
Playing a recorder into the phone to capture the message on the answering
machine. Insane. What the heck?
So he had this laid out. Esposito was a witness to the crime and told police that Katie Beers had been kidnapped by someone that he had seen at Spaceplex.
He was the one who had her there, right? I mean,
right. That's what I'm saying.
And then it was sort of his alibi that he was there too. But really what happened was he was there with her and he had taken her to his home. And like, it is better than a pit latrine, but the action is still really terrible. He had built a 6-foot by 7-foot concrete bunker under his garage. He did it specifically because he was going to take this specific little girl. And it was concealed by a 200-pound concrete trap door. The bunker contained a commode toilet, television set, mattress, and restraints. So, I mean, this guy is, you know, this took a lot of planning. And in fact, they were talking about how kids in the neighborhood had played in the dirt mounds where he had dug out the area for the bunker.
Including Katie.
Which is so messed up. And so this guy, this is the kind of person who should scare everybody.
His story, I mean, obviously, this is sort of the end of the story. On January 13th, 1993, Katie Beers is found alive in the bunker.
Right. She was only held for 16 days. And I say only, but I mean, that I'm sure it was hellacious, but she could have been held for so much longer.
Yeah. And John Esposito, so he gets arrested. He's convicted on July 27th, 1994. And he's sentenced to 15 years to life. And they sent him off to Sing Sing. And then September 4th, 2013, by this point, Esposito has had 4 parole hearings. That would have been 20 years. So it's been denied. He's still in jail. But he was found dead in his cell of what they believe is natural causes. Now, due to neglect from her mother and abuse by her godmother's husband that she had experienced before the kidnapping, Beers was sent to live with foster parents in East Hampton, New York, and she was raised by the foster family until adulthood. Beers said that Esposito had raped her during captivity. He wasn't charged with this. He was sentenced for 15 years to life for the kidnapping itself.
Right. And the judge agreed.
But she did survive.
She most likely was sexually assaulted, even though he wasn't charged with it. I would certainly say that somebody that could do that to us. I mean, why else would he have taken her to look at her? I mean,
that is one of those cases that I, to this day, do not understand what was happening. Like, I don't understand what took over that guy. I don't know what he was thinking.
It really is kind of, I think any situation where you're going to put a child of pretty much any age into a cage of whatever kind. Now, in this case, he didn't leave her there to die. He essentially wanted to keep her. So do you think that it really is that they can't bring themselves to kill? Like in the case of Lori Polan, you think that the guy just couldn't bring himself to kill her?
Absolutely. It's partly, you can call it a lapse or a break or whatever you want to call it, but something about taking that last step makes them stop. That doesn't mean they won't eventually kill someone. It just means in this instance, they're not killing this person. And so the way that that works is very tricky, very, very tricky. If you were to ask particular people, had they killed this person whose bones were found 20 years later, 10 years later, 5 years later, the answer is no.
Right.
For them. And they pass the polygraph. And as far as they're concerned, even though legally speaking, you sit there and say, you caused this, and that is, say it was argued under like the felony murder doctrine. You did this kidnapping, and because of that kidnapping, they died. Fine. But as far as a non-legal perspective, they think, I have not killed anyone.
Well, and
I had a line.
And in that regard, they would pass a polygraph if they believed that.
Right. So here's the thing about all killers that kill more than one person. When you sit down and look at them, they have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Beginning is that's how they start. That's their first kills or their first abductions or their first, the first abductions, that's when they dip their toes in the water of what will eventually become their murder career or whatever you want to call it. But when you ask killers about these things, even killers like Ted Bundy, they don't really talk about the first things they did.
Because they end up like screwing things up.
Right. There were so many mistakes made. So the middle of a killer's career, that's when they hit their prime and their stride. So they're good at it. They're good at whatever it is they're doing. They still might make mistakes or whatever, but if that's the thing they've chosen to do, they spend a period of time where they're decent at it. And then the end. The end is, if you picture it like a bell curve, the beginning is one side, the prime is in the middle, but when they start going back downhill, that's when they start making mistakes and getting arrested for driving and getting arrested for driving around through ATMs where some Texas Ranger could identify their Ford Focus. They're making mistakes again. They're decompensating. So on one side, they were on an uphill swing. So the mistakes were them learning. They've gotten to the top. They don't get the rush anymore. The things that they're now doing for the rush that they need start to take them down the other side of the bell. And that's when you end up hearing about it and seeing
it. I can't, though, as much as I've looked into into serial killers sort of in general, I can't get into that mindset. And so you feel like it is the rush.
You can call it a rush. You can call it an itch. For me, the thing that happens is I get creative. I do writing or I make a video project. It sounds crazy to say, but it's the same thing.
Some writing projects
I finish, some video projects I don't finish. Like, but my process for having that idea and the idea, like, you know, gestating and then bothering me until I do whatever, like video or writing or whatever it is, it's the same thing they're going through. Like, it's my thing that I really like I do. It's what I would call myself. I would never be able to understand stuff involving other people, period, let alone killing them.
Well, because I was going to say, like, and I guess my brain's just wired differently, but I'm always interested, from a very young age, I've always been interested to know how somebody else sees something, like their perspective. And so I've never had anything that was like so ingrained in my head that I couldn't be like, yeah, I'm not going to do this. I'm just going to go take a nap or whatever. And so I have a really hard time with how you get there. And then, of course, we've been talking about missing children, but, you know, as far as kids go, like, I'm always curious to know, like, oh, what kind of behaviors are, you know, indicative of problems later on with kids turning into serial killers? Because the best serial killers will never be caught. We'll never know a thing about them. And so it's this whole thing to me, because I really don't understand the itch or the rush or whatever. And I don't understand how it, like, what makes a brain not be able to redirect that somehow?
Well, it's similar to like people who have ADHD or OCD. You can't redirect it because it becomes consuming. And I say this from the perspective of, you could go about and do like your daily zombie routine of 8 to 5, blah, 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 whatever you're doing. You could do that. But eventually, you're going to be caught in either a moment of lowered inhibitions or you're going to be caught in a moment of boredom. And when your inhibitions are lowered, that's typically because there's a, like with a lot of these guys, you see there's substances involved, particularly alcohol. That one is the one that starts lowering inhibitions. But really what it does is it just like lets their brain kind of free for a minute. And they're bored. So if those two things happen at the same time, that's when they go, all right, well, I had this idea where I wanted to do this thing. I'll have to modify it to do this. Like, we don't – so serial killers, in a couple of different ways, serial killers are problematic. The biggest one is there is no one hunting serial killers. Like, I don't want anybody to take away anything from TV or movies or whatever and go, this serial killer is going to be caught. Occasionally you hear about them. But the truth is, who we hear about, like the first name killers and the ones that kind of like are flash in the pan killers, none of them are the problem. It's the ones in between that like authorities start to notice patterns. But even though they've noticed the pattern, they never have seen that like these things are connected because jurisdictional issues or whatever. And like, I know like you can go watch the FBI talk about profiling and you can listen to other podcasts and documentaries and you can hear people talk about profiling. But the truth is we know nothing about serial killers except that they kill. And when you hear all of these very carefully laid out, and I call them Mindhunter studies, those studies are only based on killers we caught. So those studies being based on killers we caught means that we don't know the half of what is going on with the ones we haven't caught. And the problem with behavioral profiling is it's more applicable to things like serial rapes or serial arsons or bank robbery because you can try and predict what's going to happen there. The FBI has laid their whole story out related to Israel Keyes on the idea that he acted randomly, took people from remote locations, and disposed of them in a way that their bodies would never be found. But the truth is, the FBI did not come up with that. Okay, Israel Keyes told them that, and he told the U.S. Attorney's Office that, and they went, okay, well, that's his MO. So right there, like with someone as prolific as Keyes happening in 2012, or I guess better phrasing would be, with someone as potentially as prolific as Israel Keyes happening in 2012, if we were studying Kemper, Dahmer, Bundy in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, shouldn't we know how to interrogate him, question him, interview him, let him talk?
It was a very big eye-opening experience for me.
So one of the problems that I have with the FBI, and one of the things that we're going to start exploring soon, is there are still cases that Keyes could potentially be connected to that they just sit on all of the information. And there's a couple of those that are going to come up in our summer programming. Did you have anything else you want to say about the missing and kidnapped girls?
No. It's all just, you know, anytime it has to do with kids, it's overwhelming. And, if you know, Lori Poland's story is very inspiring. It's crazy that these are like the very few and far between examples of sort of what seems to me like it should be really obvious. But it's not. But we did find, you know, examples of the outhouse cesspool being used.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that's going to bother me for a really long time. And, like, I am trying to figure out a way to get more. It's very hard to search those places. Like it's complicated. It requires multiple parts depending on where you're searching.
I think that I would like to think, and I think everybody would like to think that like there's no, we have a system in place somehow in our national park system or whatever, where like it's not possible that people could have been disposed of. Okay. And then I just being, you know, a citizen of the United States, you know, you just don't think things like that. Somebody's taking care of that, right? I mean, isn't that what most people think? We listen to Keyes talk for like 2 seconds and we realize, oh my gosh, he's absolutely right. And he can't possibly be the only person who's thought of this.
And the truth is, he got caught when he deviated from it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was part of it. And I, you know, we've talked about like forever and ever, why would he have put Samantha Koenig in the water as opposed to a pit latrine? And we thought the ground was probably frozen or something. There was something there.
Well, they had also replaced the latrine with a large portable toilet shortly.
When we talk about that, that is a difference, right? Portable toilet doesn't have the big hole we're talking about here.
Pit latrines, the ones that we're looking for, they have a 9 to 20 foot deep hole underneath an outhouse. Frequently, it has some form of toilet and usually some form of urinal that feed into it. But this is, that's the, what?
He's just looking at it.
Ugh. Yeah, that's a pit latrine. So then, there's also vaulted toilets, which I think I showed you in one of the videos from one of the locations. The vaulted toilet is, it's similar to a pit latrine. It has very basic rudimentary plumbing to it in that they can clean it out. But it doesn't have running water in the toilet part. It's still going into a hole. It just has a vault where some of the materials can be removed. Some of the waste can be removed in a vaulted toilet. But for the most part, the pit latrines, and it's weird. If you go on a map and just take your location or some approximate location in your city, you have to look under different names. It could be outhouse, remote toilet, vaulted toilet, pit toilet, camping toilet, primitive toilet. But you probably have one much closer to you than you realize. And I think that people, if they would like, it sounds so crazy to have to like drive this home. Okay, first of all, records aren't kept. People don't care. As long as you had your little toilet paper roll for your summer jaunt to the state park or the national park or national forest, I promise you, no one has looked in that hole that you just pooped in.
Why would they? The whole reason they put it there is so it's not out on the ground. I mean,
exactly. And so, you know, they've inadvertently created these
opportunities.
It's an opportunity. It's the weirdest thing to me that we have this many missing people. And, you know, I know that people burn people. I know that people go into water. I'm aware that people are buried. I know that some people are just left out in the woods. And that's the part where it gets hard to get people to take you seriously is when you know something is happening. You have examples of it happening. And you have areas where you want to look. It's not that they don't want you to look or they're stopping you from looking. It's that we couldn't tell you. We don't give a shit about shit. We don't know where that hole was.
And at the end of the day, I mean, it really is true. Unless it's somebody specifically connected to the person, it kind of rolls off their back because, I mean, they're not going to go look through the shit to see if the person's there. And I don't blame them. But it really, it's so disgusting.
So we're going to start next week, kicking off the Summer of Keys. And what I'm hoping that we can do is we can illuminate a few cases that were not on my radar because of some things that had happened with Namus and with the FBI. They are now on my radar. And I want to talk about those cases. You've got a couple of things that you want to talk about related to Keys, but I was hoping like the biggest thing you bring to the table is I have one queued up where you can look at it. I'm hoping that you will look at some of these cases and explain to me why you rule them out Keys wise.
Did you want me to do that on the recording? I can do that later.
Because we're trying to talk about him, and when I say him, I'm talking about Israel Keyes, but we're trying to talk about the cases without talking about him as much, just saying, no, he was not there.
Right, so basically what has happened here is you want to do Keyes, and I'm like, let's just talk about the cases. So that's what this is, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the gist of what we're doing. It's like, I really am... It takes a lot to get your side of it out. I can tell pieces of it, but I want to hear more about what you think, because you have sort of a... You've got a couple of things that you've been talking about. One of those things was, I've got to decide, did he kill prostitutes or not, that we know.
Right, because I feel like that's a pretty strong line.
Right, and I actually think he did, and I think you're aware of it at this point. And I think the FBI knows it. I think the FBI has three closed case files that are, and when I say closed, I mean they've decided that information is not going to be released about them. There's one specific one from Washington State. There's a couple from the area that would basically be like Delaware-ish. And I think the FBI thinks or knows that Israel Keyes is involved, and they've closed that off from us.
Why do you think they closed it off?
I don't know. That's the thing that's driving me crazy at this point.
One thing you could think of is just how it kind of went down with Debra Feldman, I guess, or the idea of Debra Feldman, and it wasn't like...
I think they don't want to be proven wrong.
Well, I don't know that. I mean,
he wasn't Googling Debra Feldman from Hackensack, New Jersey.
Well, they also, like, Debra Feldman's still a missing person. There's been no closure there, so I don't see how them not saying something about another case is going to help them not be wrong about her. Like,
well, the couriers, even though we have a detailed description there,
they're still missing people.
And so we have these comparison searches, and we have four things on the comparison searches that are they're considered to be closed and resolved, right?
And there's four people, right?
Right. So I went looking through these, and I think I found three of them. And that's where we're going to pick up next week, is we're going to talk about those three cases, because those people deserve to be talked about, particularly some of them have now been found. Obviously, by the time of the comparison searches, at least a couple of them had been found. We're going to look at why I think it's them. And then we're going to start to discuss cases that could potentially be linked to Israel Keyes in Texas. You found a missing couple that, like, is... You basically said, if this is not Keyes, they're in this water. And I looked at it, and, like, it would be very similar to the couriers. But you said something that was... really shocking to me, and that was, what a fucking coward, or what a loser.
Well, I think I just said, so it's my opinion, and this is not to be disrespectful to the victims, but it's my opinion that somebody, if you listen to Israel Keyes' confession of the courier murder, the way that he talks about the couriers and how he knew exactly what he wanted and he knew what he was getting, based on just sort of looking around and the garage and the car beforehand, he was looking for people that were older and might have health problems. And if it's not, I don't want to say it's not a challenge, because I feel like it definitely, I don't want anybody to take that kind of challenge, but it's almost like he preyed upon weaker people because it made him feel better. I'm sure I probably said, you know, he's such a coward. And in that particular case, it was an elderly couple, which they see, this is where the line sort of, you know, we start with it, because it's entirely possible these people drove off a bridge by accident, right? And I try to think to myself, well, you know, would their loved ones want to know that? Would it be offensive if I said, what if the serial killer did it? And so I also think it would be more helpful if somehow we could have some sort of central car situation where, like, no matter where the car was found, because see, if their car was found, I would say, well, that clearly didn't happen, because you've got to be in your car to drive it off the bridge. But that's not, you know, that's not the case. I did see this case. I specifically found it, and I did sort of a side-by-side comparison with what if we didn't know what had happened to Bill and Lorraine Currier from their killer's mouth. And it's a little bit, so if you look at it from that point of view, you've got, there was glass between the garage door and the house that Keyes broke when he went in and blitz attack them. So it then essentially Bill and Lorraine were gone. Several suitcases with just random stuff was gone, and their gun was gone. So in that situation, if we didn't know that Israel Keyes had done what he did to them, what would we think had happened? Well, it would seem like the two of them went off together, and because the gun was gone, unless there was some other plausible explanation for where the gun ended up, we would think, well, it was probably like a murder-suicide or something to that effect. I think that part of it, though, is, so if you look at it from that point of view, like, we would all think one of them was more than likely responsible. I mean, is that a pretty logical conclusion?
Thanks for joining us. You can reach us at 252-365-5593 or at truecrimexcess.com or truecrimexcess@gmail.com if you want to send us a note. This episode was brought to you by LabrotiCreations.com. That's LabrotiCreations.com. Check out the merchandise and specifically their fun pop pet art custom pieces made from photos of your very own pets. Use the promo code CRIMEXS, that's CRIMEXS, for 20% off a fun, brightly colored, happy piece of art of your own pet at their site. AbradiCreations.com. Music in this episode was licensed for True Crime XS. The theme song was Indestructible by Noah Smith. You can find us on your favorite podcast platform or at TeePublic, Instagram, or Twitter. You can also join us on Patreon to fund future body exploration trips. But the best thing you can do for us is leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform and share us with your friends. And we'll see you next time. Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly who you're missing. I know I look desperate, but the day that we met was a lost case of bed. I don't regret one moment. I know that you don't love me, and I'm either sad or crazy, but as long as you still hold me, I love you enough for the both of us. Just lie to me, tell me I'm everything you want, 'cause honestly I'd rather put up with the front than having to deal with the day-to-day pain of knowing I'm here because she didn't stay. Lie to me, just lie to me. I'm not angry, and I really can't be. I made you my life, knowing full well you might not have even been ready. I know how this seems, but I gotta believe, when you're finally done and your heart gives her up, we can be all that I dreamed. I know that you don't love me, and I'm either sad or crazy, but as long as you still hold me, I love you enough for the both of us. Just lie to me, tell me I'm everything you want, 'cause honestly I'd rather put up with the front than having to deal with the day-to-day pain of knowing because she didn't stay. Lie to me, just lie to me. Do better than her. Please don't go back to her. Just lie to me, tell me I'm everything you want. Cause honestly, I'd rather put up with the front than having to deal with the day-to-day pain, knowing I'm here because she walked away. Lie to me, just lie to me. Just lie to me. Tell me I'm everything you want. Cause honestly, I'd rather put up with